Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now you can hear our program live weekday morning 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
And as well as connecting faith to life, I hope you're able to connect point A to point B with your travel plans. Yeah, it's a very busy travel week, and today's likely to be pretty crazy. It's now 6:04 Central Time. And good morning. Welcome. The Faith Radio Network is what you're listening to. I'm Austin Hill here weekday morning 6 till 8 as we connect faith to life and get your day started. Day number two, I'm doing a countdown here. Day number two of the busiest travel week of the year. And of course, tomorrow and Thursday will be especially chaotic. But today, it'll be crazy enough. If you're even if you're not flying anywhere, if you have to travel by car, by bus, or public transportation anywhere near an airport, allow for some extra travel time. And of course, weather conditions are slowing things down as well. But the work goes on, and we're glad you're here. Now, a little bit later this morning, we'll check in with a gentleman named Byron Medlock. He's from Fargo, the Fargo-Moorhead area, and he's in Fargo, North Dakota with the Salvation Army. Now, a group like the Salvation Army, customarily you think of groups like the Salvation Army serving up Thanksgiving Day meals on a week like this, right? But the truth is, the service of the Salvation Army and other ministries like them, the service work goes on year-round, and so do the needs for you and I to volunteer, to make donations, to serve up resources and such. And we're spending some time this week in particular highlighting some of the folks who are about the business of caring for the least of these. Hence, Byron Medlock, our guest a little bit later this morning. Philip Yancey, I bet you know that name. Philip Yancey, who for years was a prolific writer and editor at Christianity Today. He still is a senior editor at Christianity Today magazine. He has a new book out called Vanishing Grace. Now, Philip Yancey turned a lot of heads back, 12, 15 years ago with a couple of books in a series entitled What's So Amazing About Grace? And that was quite an eye-opener, provocative book series that he wrote. His new one, Vanishing Grace, suggests that the Christian community lacks sufficient grace at times and does not impart sufficient grace to the broader culture. So we'll get Philip Yancey's thoughts on that. Philip Yancey, author extraordinaire, joining us later this morning. So also our great friend Abdu Murray, author of the book Grand Central Question. Abdu Murray, quite expert in the ways of cultural tension and competing ideologies and worldviews and finding our way as Christians in a very, very diverse and complex world. We'll talk with him some more about Christian-Islamic relations and problems with radical Islam in the Western world, in the United States, Canada, and Europe as well. He'll be back with us coming up later this morning as well. Now, I'm happy to tell you that we here at Faith Radio are helping out with Angel Tree. That is a program of Prison Fellowship Ministries. And Angel Tree is an opportunity that presents an opportunity to you and I to help come alongside and provide and fulfill needs for the children of incarcerated adults across the country. Now, Prison Fellowship, of course, founded all those many years ago by one late great Charles Colson. Prison Fellowship has been ministering to those behind bars for really ever since its inception. But the Angel Tree program is an outreach, an extension of what they do with the adults, specifically targeting children. Later this morning, we'll hear testimony from a pastor who has seen firsthand the work of Angel Tree, and we'll kind of go behind the scenes and get a view from the back room, so to speak, and it'll be, I think, probably very, very inspiring. Of course, we have a phone number just for Faith Radio listeners. We encourage you to call and help out. Real easy to remember. Just remember this, okay? It's 855 area code, 855-59-ANGEL, 855-59-ANGEL. And for the low dollar figure of $84, you can help out 6 kids during the Christmas season. $169 will reach a dozen children. And again, these are kids of incarcerated adults. Just call the number and to get all the info. And we invite you, we encourage you to come on board. 855-59-ANGEL. That's 855-59-ANGEL. But again, you'll hear an up-close and personal testimony on this one coming up a little bit later this morning. So all this and more just ahead. We're glad you're with us. It's the Faith Radio Network Tuesday underway as we make our way slowly but steadily, plodding through the ice and the snow towards Thanksgiving Day. Stand by. We'll check in and get an update on the great work of the Salvation Army at this time of the year. Also, author Philip Yancey, our guest in moments. It's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. We're glad you're with us. It's now 6:11. Good morning and welcome to Tuesday from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Thanksgiving Day is on the way, and I hope you and I hope myself and everybody listening has a blessed day, a day set aside to give thanks and to enjoy the many blessings, time with our families and friends and good food. Of course, not all of us have good friends or family or food at hand. And that's when great charities come into play. That's when it's time for you and I to step up and offer the cup of cool water and the delicious turkey dinner in Jesus' name, if you will. A lot of great organizations help organize that as well. One of them being the Salvation Army, with a very long-standing tradition and history here in the United States of America. Joining us from the Fargo chapter of the Salvation Army in North Dakota, Major Byron Medlock. He's a Corps officer with the Salvation Army in Fargo. Major Medlock, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be on.
It's a pleasure to be with you, sir, and a very happy Thanksgiving Day ahead of time for you and yours. Tell us about the, for those who are, it's difficult to imagine anybody within the reach of our voices here, not familiar on a pretty substantial level with the Salvation Army, but for those of us who maybe need a refresher course, tell us what the Salvation Army does.
Salvation Army does the holistic view of an individual. We take the spiritual, the physical, and the mental, and we try to meet the needs in every area and to meet the needs of the people that we come across.
Very good. And in Fargo specifically, you're gearing up for what is probably going to be very busy. It's probably already busy this week, but as the week progresses, it'll get even more busy into Thanksgiving Day. Tell us about that.
Oh yeah, we've already taken a 350 applications for Thanksgiving baskets that we will be giving out on the 24th of November. We are now in the process of taking Christmas applications where we may give away anywhere to 800 to 1,000 baskets of food. And so we're very busy, right? And also our Christmas kettle kicks off Friday. So things are picking up and there'll be some long hours and a lot of ringing and happy people.
Sure. Major Byron Medlock with the Salvation Army, he's on our guest line here on Faith Radio, and he's in the Fargo area of North Dakota. Major Medlock, I'm sure you've encountered this before, but clearly on multiple fronts, the economy in Fargo, North Dakota is really doing quite well. It's one of the bright spots in the overall economy across the United States of America, and yet you see where people fall through the cracks. You see, despite the headlines of low unemployment and high wages and those kinds of things, you see the suffering. Give us the other side of the coin, the story that a lot of us just don't see from Fargo these days.
Well, the oil boom has created, a very well economic blessing to the North Dakota state. But on the other hand, a lot of people come, and the problem is that you can find a job, but out there in the oil fields, but there's no place to stay, and so then they can't stay there, and they start migrating backwards, and so they end up in Fargo, and then they're homeless, or they need a place to stay, or they need the food, and they need to get home. So it's a double-edged sword. Sometimes it's good for the community, but sometimes it backfires as well.
Yeah,
and find ourselves in that position. We're dealing with more people trying to either get back home or just can't get a job.
Now, well, tell us about that. Let's talk about the person who, despite the robust job creation, can't find a position of employment. How do you and your associates at the Salvation Army step in and address that issue?
Well, we work really hard with getting them a place to stay, and then we look for for jobs. They find jobs, and then they say, well, they may need, let's say, boots to work at. So they'll come to the Salvation Army, and then we can issue them boots so they can get their job. That the hard-toed boots that sometimes does small, you know, you think shoes can keep you from getting a job? Yes, it can be. Or it could be safety glasses, you know, a coat, something, gloves and scarf. You'd be surprised. A lot of the work is outside, so it gets very cold. And so there's a lot of things that we can do to help them get a job if they have the right proper equipment.
Mm. And, of course, we're headed into the time of the year, the Thanksgiving season. You mentioned the Christmas Kettle program starts right after Thanksgiving. What are the unique needs and, I guess, the stresses and strains on the resources of the Salvation Army at this time of the year, things that hopefully the rest of us can pitch in and help with?
Well, you know, it's a traditional, the heating, the rent, gasoline sometimes to get to and from the doctor, food, and all those things come in very hard on Christmas time. Like you said at the beginning of your program, some people don't have that chance to have a Thanksgiving because there's no family around them. And so we tried to help that out by providing a Thanksgiving dinner the day before Thanksgiving and also a Christmas Eve dinner. So they at least get that meal and at least have the fellowship of others around them.
Major Byron Medlock with the Salvation Army. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network as we get closer and closer to Thanksgiving Day. Folks like Major Medlock and others who work with the Salvation Army and related organizations, this is a very busy time of the year for them. For those who are saying, you know, I need to do more, I'm blessed with a home, with a family, or friends, and I have a place to stay, I need to do more to help those who don't have those great benefits in their life. But just simply writing a check or phoning in a credit card pledge at this time of the year, I don't want it to stop there. Certainly that's a good start, but what do you tell the person who wants to be a part of the solution year-round?
Well, we have many, many opportunities here at the Salvation Army. We have a feeding program that feeds 7 days a week, 2 days a week, breakfast and lunch 5 days, and lunch on Saturday and meal on Sunday. So the opportunity to help volunteers to serve the food or to prepare the food or just be a part of the group walking around talking, there is a lot of things going on in the Salvation Army that people can volunteer to help.
My understanding is that, of course, the Salvation Army has a website with an easily recognized URL, but for your region, for both North Dakota and I believe the state of Minnesota as well, the website would be salvationarmynorth.org. Is that the right
That's
place
correct.
To
That's
to gravitate?
That's correct. And you could type in Fargo and it will bring up the Fargo page.
Yeah, that's good. Do you ever face the threat or the concern about running out of food on a Thanksgiving Day?
Oh no, we prepare for a lot of food, and we get we give out our baskets. We make sure that we buy enough food to fill all the baskets completely. Mm-hmm. And then when we do our Thanksgiving dinner, we make sure that we know that Thanksgiving is going to be very busy, so we prepare a lot more food for them because we give them a really good helping of food when they go through the line, so they're very satisfied when they go through it. Yeah, we make sure that we make the need and we don't run out.
Major Byron Medlock with the Salvation Army in Fargo. Major Medlock, thanks so much for what you do. May God bless you at this time of the year. And thanks for spending some time with us. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
It's now 6:19. It's the Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. And I'm Austin Hill. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. More about the ministry of Angel Tree coming up in just moments. Good morning. It's now 6:21 from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. We have an opportunity now, and I want you to give a listen to this testimony, this recorded testimony. You're going to hear the words of a pastor from the Bronx in New York City who has seen firsthand the work of the Angel Tree Ministry up close. Now, when I say up close, well, you'll hear in this audio feature exactly what we mean by that, but I'll also tell you in moments about your opportunity, an opportunity that you and I both have to share Christ's love by helping to meet the physical, emotional, and spiritual needs of the families of imprisoned individuals at Christmas time.
Michael Carrion, pastor at Promised Land Covenant Church in New York City, the Bronx, shares an Angel Tree story that is very personal.
Let me tell you the story about a little 9-year-old boy. His mom and dad were heroin addicts, and they paid for their habit by taking that little boy and his younger sister up to people's homes, knocking on their doors, and asking for a drink of water for their children. Once inside, the couple would pull out knives and guns. They would begin to tie up and just rob and pillage every apartment they walked into. As you can imagine, the children who were exposed to this life of trauma and violence were damaged goods. They were lost, fearful, broken. The father is arrested. Several weeks after that, so is the mother. The grandparents of these children had rose up as a champion and fought for them not to go into the foster care system. Soon after that, just before Christmas, there was a knock at the door. There's a tall African-American gentleman there. And he asks the grandmother, "Is Mike and is Letty home?" And as they come to the door, this tall man says, "I know that your mother and father can't be here with you, but they love you. And these gifts are for you. Daddy can't be here. Mommy can't be here, but we want you to know that Jesus is here for you." As this man prayed, he felt a presence come into the hallway of this project building. Years later, this young man goes down the same path that his parents went, finds himself addicted to crack cocaine. He has a friend that tells him, "I'm not going to leave you lost." He's taken to a evangelistic outreach service. As this young man is responding to that call, he remembers the visit of a man in the project hallway. Life changed for this young man. Soon gets involved with the local church and learns that Jesus stepped out of glory and put on humanity so that he would not be lost. My name is Reverend Dr. Michael Carrion, and more than 20 years later, God has continued to work a miracle in my life. That seed planted that day positioned me to respond to the call of Christ, to perpetually serve, to reach out and to evangelize on Rikers Island. We covet your prayers here in the South Bronx. There are so many kids that are lost. Pray for the Angel Tree kids, not only in the South Bronx, but all over the country. I believe that revival will start because of Angel Tree seeds that are planted by the missionaries that will bring the good news.
Pastor Michael Carrion pastors a church right in the neighborhood where his parents were arrested. He also planted 6 churches in the Bronx, with plans for 14 more. Pastor Michael was an Angel Tree kid. This year, there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of little boys just like Mike who could grow up to be dedicated, humble, eager servants in God's kingdom. In every case, it starts with an Angel Tree gift, which means it starts with you.
Isn't that great? If you'd like to make a difference in the life of one of the 2.7 million children of incarcerated adults in the United States, well, call right now, 855-59-ANGEL. That's 855-59-ANGEL. Angel Treats, an outreach and prison fellowship. Faith Radio is proud to partner with these ministries over the coming weeks to meet this very large and growing need. You can find more information at myfaithradio.com on our homepage. It's now 625. I'm Austin Hill. We'll be right back. Take a look at what's coming up on Connecting Faith with Neil Stavem. That's today at 12 noon Central Time. It's all right here on Faith Radio. Good morning, it's Faith Radio, and I'm Austin Hill. Connecting Faith is heard weekdays at 12 noon Central Time here on the Faith Radio Network. Yesterday, host Neil Stavem had a very intriguing discussion with a man who actually intentionally lived as a homeless person for 6 months on the streets of American cities. His name is Mike Yankoski, and his new book is called Under the Overpass. Let's listen in.
I was in Portland, Oregon not too long ago, and I had some extra money and some extra time, and so I bought some burritos. I mean, these are simple $2.50 bean and cheese burritos. And I walked around downtown Portland for a couple of hours and, you know, offered these burritos to people who were on the streets. And, you know, sometimes people cussed me out, told me off, said they hated me, they hated burritos, they weren't hungry, they didn't want to talk to me, they didn't want to have a burrito. And so I said, okay, that's fine, I hope you have a good day. And I went to the next person. One of these guys I sat down next to, you know, I offered him a burrito, and he said, yeah, thanks, that'd be great. I haven't eaten in a while. It'd be fantastic. And so we just started talking, you know, while he was eating the burrito, and we're talking about whatever, you know, baseball, basketball, football, politics, weather. You know, if you could go anywhere, where would you go in the States? Or where's your favorite place? Where have you traveled? You know, those kinds of questions, just general conversational type questions. Halfway through his burrito, he turned to me and he said, Mike, do you know you've changed my week? And I thought, you know, what are you talking about, man? It's a $2.50 bean and cheese burrito. And what do you mean it's changed your week? And he said, no, I'm serious. It's not the burrito. I mean, the burrito's fine, but you're the first person who's talked to me in a week. Thank you. And I mean, I was blown away at that point, right? Because it's like, here's 5 minutes of my day and $2.50 worth of bean and cheese burrito. And it's an opportunity to rehumanize somebody. I think it's one of the most fascinating lenses through which to read the gospel stories. We consistently see Jesus rehumanizing the people who are on the margins of his society, the people who are the outcasts, the people who the quote-unquote respectable people in Jesus' day will not associate with. They'll have nothing to do with them, the people who are on the margins, the leper, the people who are paralyzed, the prostitutes, the sinners, the quote-unquote tax collectors. These are the people who Jesus, again and again in the gospel, consistently makes an effort to go and to be with. And as he's with them, he rehumanizes them. He relates with them. He treats them like they're human beings. He treats them like they are human beings created in the image of God. And I think that that's one of the most important things that we need to keep in mind, particularly as people who are Christians, who are claiming to be followers of Christ, a willingness to rehumanize one another by the way we treat one another. Not treating one another merely as problems to be solved, but treating one another as people created in the image of the creating, sustaining, and redeeming God. And I think that that means looking one another in the eyes, treating one another like we're human beings, not treating one another like we're just a waste of time or waste of space or waste of life. I think that that's a very important aspect of how we respond to one another and how we treat the men and women of our community who are in desperate economic situations.
Fascinating discussion with host Neil Stavem and author Mike Yankoski on yesterday's Connecting Faith program. Coming up on today's episode, host Neil Stavem talks with Brian Ficard. He's the author of When Helping Hurts. That's today, 12 noon Central Time, Connecting Faith with Neil Stavem here on the Faith Radio Network. In just moments, we'll talk with the eloquent author Philip Yancey about his brand new book, Vanishing Grace. You know the name, now let's hear from him again and find out about his latest work. That's just ahead. It's now 6:31. I'm Austin Hill. SRN News on the way. This is the Faith Radio Network. Good morning. It's now 6:35, and you're listening to listener-supported Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Here's a challenging question for you. Does the church lack a sense of grace? That's probably a question that some of us would prefer not to answer, but maybe a follow-up question to that is, why does the church, the movement of Christians, in our country and in our culture anyway, seem to be stirring up a lot of negative responses and negative feelings? My next guest is a man who's no stranger to church and culture issues. He serves as editor-at-large for Christianity Today magazine. He's written 13 gold medallion award-winning books. You know him very well. His name is Philip Yancey. His latest book, Vanishing Grace, is what we're discussing. Philip, welcome to the program. Good to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Austin.
This is not the first time you've undertaken this issue of church and grace and perceptions of the church in the broader culture. Tell us where you're going with this one.
15 years ago or so, I wrote a book called What's So Amazing About Grace.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, when I was writing that, my working title was What's So Amazing About Grace and Why Don't Christians Show More of It? And my publisher convinced me, you can't get that many words on the jacket of the book.
Doesn't fit on the binder, right?
Especially the spine, right.
Right.
And, but when I was writing it, I got so enraptured with grace itself and the stories that Jesus told and how we can play that out person to person and family issues, things like that, that my original concern of Christians, how they're perceived by the rest of society, I changed from that, and I took about 150 pages out of the first draft and just put them aside. Since that time, Austin, things have gotten even worse. We live in a very divided, polarized society,
mm-hmm.
and I came across this statistic that whereas it used to be, in 1996, 85% of non-church people still had a favorable impression of Christians. Now it's down to 16%. So I wanted to find out what happened in recent times to make people have such negative impressions of Christians. I didn't know the answer.
Right.
When I don't know the answer to something, I write a book about it because it gives me a chance to explore it.
Sure. No, and I remember very well when your book, What's So Amazing About Grace, came out, and a lot of water has flowed under the bridge, Philip Yancey, since that time. Our world has probably turned upside down multiple times since then. And it does seem as though, even just here in the United States, it certainly does seem as though we are a more bitter and divided culture than we were even when that first book came out. What happened? What transpired? And was there insufficient grace infused into the culture over this period of time? What's your assessment of that?
Some of it is media stereotypes. They always go to the radicals, to the wackos. So you've got these images of people like from this church in Kansas that protests veterans' funerals and holds mm-hmm. up God hates flag, you know, God hates fag signs and things like that. And universities have a real problem. They perceive Christians as intolerant and anti-gay, anti-sex, anti-science. So those stereotypes are part of it. And I think part of it, and this is why I'm addressing the church, part of it is our response. When culture changes, we used to have kind of a built-in acceptance by the culture, and that's changing. So how do you respond? You can either respond by hostility or fear,
mm-hmm.
or I'm saying, look, let's look back in the days that Jesus and Paul in the early church were facing a culture that's much more hostile, much more non-Christian than ours. Learn from them about what they told us and how they actually responded and the effect it had in the early days of Christianity. That's what we can learn from.
Mm. Philip Yancey, his latest book entitled Banishing Grace, Whatever Happened to the Good News? He's on our guest line here on Faith Radio. Is the gospel of Jesus Christ, powerful as it is it somehow being construed as something less than or different than good news in our culture? Is it being misrepresented in some sense, would you say?
That's right. A lot of people, when you interview them and ask them, describe a Christian for me, they don't usually use positive words.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus was beautiful. He's working at dealing with people who must have been very offensive to him. And what I learned is it really doesn't take grace to be around somebody who's just like you. Grace is put to the test when you're around somebody who's very different than you, maybe offensive to you.
Right.
And we can learn from Jesus, because every time he had that hostility or found a person who was just in denial, he would find a way to awaken the thirst that is in them. I use the example of the woman at the well, John 4. You know, she's had 5 failed marriages. She's living with a man. She's probably an outcast from the community. And she keeps wanting to talk about theology. Which mountain should we worship on? Jesus won't have any of it. He just goes right to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
I sense that you're thirsty. What you've been drinking, does it satisfy you? And I think if we Christians are sensitive, know how to awaken that thirst, and then know how to respond to it in a life-giving way, then we can become what I call grace dispensers. Instead of furthering the division and the polarization in this world around us. We can become the people that others look at and say, what do they have? I want to be like those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not want to write a scolding book. So I filled my book with illustrations of people who actually do that in a compelling way.
Right. If indeed we are to be grace dispensers, and yet we're navigating this terrain where this is not the United States of America that either one of us grew up in, Filippiansi, it's certainly not the U.S. of A. of our parents or grandparents' generation.
Right.
It's a country and a culture that has, in many ways, turned on the Christian faith and is becoming more and more hostile to it. How do we go about that that enterprise, if you will, of being grace dispensers in a culture that in many ways wants nothing to do, if not with us, it certainly doesn't want anything to do with our core values or our stated beliefs or our convictions, especially moral convictions? How do you do that?
Many people, when they look at the trends in the United States, are afraid. And I understand that feeling of we're losing something that was vitally important that made us great. But there's another part of me that says, the worse our culture gets, the more it's like the culture that Jesus faced and Paul faced. You think the U.S. is bad? Go back and study the Roman Empire. We've got
sure.
NFL football. They had gladiators killing each other. People would pay money to see murders every week in a
mm-hmm.
stadium. We have abortion. They would go ahead and let the babies be born and just abandon them by the side of the road. So how did Christians respond? It wasn't a democracy. They couldn't protest. They couldn't vote. But what they did was show the world a different way of being human. So when plague would hit a little town in Rome, all the locals would leave, the neighbors and the families, except the Christians. They would stay behind, risking their lives to treat the ill pagans who in some cases had been negative and hostile toward them. When the babies were abandoned, the Christians would bring them in, nurse them back to health, adopt them out. And after a while, Romans started looking at these people and say, wow, I like the way they live more than I like the way I live.
Mm-hmm.
They know why they're living, and they're caring, compassionate people. And I think that's what we're called to do. We're called to show the world this vengeful, dog-eat-dog, competitive, ranking society that we live in is not the only way to be human. There's another way. There's a better way. It's Jesus' way. And if we live that out, then indeed people will, instead of having these negative impressions of Christians, will say, huh, I want what they've got.
Yeah, very interesting. Filippiansi, he is editor-at-large for Christianity Today magazine. You know his work well, I would imagine. His new book is called Banishing Grace. We'll continue with Filippiansi in just a few moments, as long as the snow doesn't pile up on the phone lines too heavily. We'll talk further. It's the Faith Radio Network that you're listening to. I'm Austin Hill. Stay with us. I know who goes before me. 646 from the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Welcome to Tuesday. We're glad you're here. Is grace vanishing from our culture? Some would say so. So also would author Filippiansi. That's the title of his new book, actually, Vanishing Grace. We're talking about it here on Faith Radio. And Philip was telling us moments ago that perhaps the goal for all of us as Christians living at such a time as this is to become grace dispensers. Philip, I want to pose a scenario here. Maybe you'll agree with this, maybe not, but it strikes me that over the recent years, maybe the last 4 to 6 years or so, Christians, evangelical Christians here in the U.S. have in many ways been kind of withdrawing or pulling back from the public square, having engendered a backlash, a pretty brutal one at times, for public policy stances that evangelicals have taken over the previous couple of decades, largely on the definition of marriage in our culture, but also perhaps on the issue of abortion and parental rights, the right to life, those kinds of things. In many cases, evangelicals seem to have checked out, and even getting back to some of your illustrations of the early Christians in the ancient Roman Empire, you pointed out that the early Christians didn't have a voice in their government. They couldn't vote. They had no option to do that. All power in the government traced back to Caesar himself, and the individual was sort of a cog in the wheel. being a grace dispenser, how do we do that in a culture where we actually are admonished to, as citizens, have a voice to participate in the creation of public policy and the creation of the culture itself? How do you put those together in your view?
It's a tricky thing, and I am not a politician. I would have a hard time being a politician because politics is an adversary sport. We just recently lived through an election, and it's a dirty pool, isn't it, where you slander, you call names, you distort the truth, and all of those are non-Christian activities. We're not supposed to do that. In fact, Jesus told us, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. I'll borrow a phrase from Martin Luther King, who says, yeah, we're fighting a war, we're fighting injustice, but we have to use different weapons. He called them the weapons of grace, so that if somebody hits me, I don't hit them back. I let them hit me. I let them throw me in jail, and I try to find a way to love them in spite of all that. I had an illustration of that, Austin. I was speaking of prayer in my church, and I hit that verse, pray for those who persecute you, love your enemies, and said, what does that mean to us today in modern America?
Mm-hmm.
So I had a slide of members of Al-Qaeda, and I said, these are our enemies. They're trying to kill us right now. They're probably assembling bombs to try to kill Americans. What would happen if every church in the United States adopted one of these guys by name, learned to pronounce his name, and started praying for him? Didn't Jesus ask us to do that? Well, I didn't know this, but there was a guy from the Army who drove about 2 hours for the service, came up from Colorado Springs, and that kind of got to him because he said, you know, I make my living by hunting down these kind of people, but I'm also supposed to pray for them.
Mm-hmm.
So he started a website called atfp.org, adoptaterroristforprayer.org. He's still in the Army. He believes it's important to protect our country, but he's also going to be praying for these people to change. And that's just one little example of how you do both. It's tricky. There are some people who do feel called to do the important work of making laws and lobbying and all that. There are some Christians in politics who feel that is their calling. We're all called to participate to vote as well. But when we do it, when we enter that realm, we use different techniques than the rest of the world uses. And if we started doing that in a strong and compelling way, I think the world would start paying attention to Christians in politics.
Hmm. One of the things that jumps out at me, Philip Yancey, is you use the illustration of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and I emphasize reverend. Unfortunately, the way he's characterized historically these days kind of tends to secularize him. And
right.
He was a pastor, and first and foremost. One of the things that strikes me about that illustration is that he was using the weapons of grace, as it were, quite willing to have a thoughtful and decisive moral voice. He was absolutely willing to say there are grave injustices going on with our government. Sometimes we get the impression the government reformed itself. Absolutely not. People in the pulpit like Reverend King and parishioners as well demanded change. How do we call out appropriately and concisely, call out injustices in our culture, whether it's in our government or elsewhere, while at the same time being the salt and light, being the contagious Christian, if you will, being the dispenser of grace, as you've described it. What are your thoughts on that?
Another illustration that I mentioned in my book has to do with the original Jane Roe in Roe versus Wade. Of course, that was a pseudonym. That was not her real name. And folks from Operation Rescue had painted her as the poster child of evil. They called her baby killer wherever she went. Something else happened. Almost to put a finger in her eye, they rented an office in the very same building, and the people who were with Planned Parenthood were appalled that here's this anti-abortion group in their same building. For a while, they were rather hostile, and then the new director of Operation Rescue tried a different tact. He didn't change his philosophy, he didn't change his belief, but he started hanging out around Jane Roe in the parking lot. And she would take a smoking break. He wasn't smoking, but he would just get to know her. He said, I don't really know about you. Tell me about yourself. One of the other members of the staff of Operation Rescue, her little daughter, started hanging around as well, and they invited her to church. And eventually, the director of Operation Rescue apologized and said, it was wrong to embarrass you, to shame you in front of these people, call you names. I'm not going to do that anymore. Well, as you may know, she had a radical conversion. She was discipled over many months before she ever went public with it. And then, of course, she was rejected by the other side, the Planned Parenthood side. But that's an example of what works. We have to care about the person as well as the policy. And the Operation Rescue found a way to do both.
Mm-hmm. And I actually saw Jane Roe, using her real name, of course, speaking in a church about 3 years ago.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yes, she's in a fascinating new place in her life. Philip Yancey, the book is called Vanishing Grace. It's his very latest, Vanishing Grace, Whatever Happened to the Good News. We've got info on it on our website at myfaithradio.com. Philip Yancey, always a pleasure to speak with you. Congratulations on yet another fine publication. We look forward to talking again soon.
I appreciate that, Austin.
It's now 6:54. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Coming up next, let's get a sneak preview of Susie Larson and her program, Live the Promise, which you'll hear this afternoon. We'll find out what she's up to next. From the Faith Radio Network, Live the Promise with Susie Larson happens every weekday afternoon, 3 till 5 p.m. Central Time. On yesterday's episode, Susie Larson welcomed author Matt Hurd to the program as they talked about his book, Life with a Capital L. And then in the second hour, Susie talked with marriage experts Bill and Pam Farrell. Let's listen into a highlight from yesterday's program.
You tell these stories of folks who maybe emphasized one area of their lives at the expense of another. For instance, Carl pursued the physical without the spiritual, so he was making all kinds of money until his son had a word to say to him. Can you remember that story? Would you mind sharing that?
Oh, sure. So often we get out of balance in terms of our pursuit of our humanity, and the overall umbrella is some people pursue physical, neglecting the spiritual. Others pursue spiritual stuff, neglecting the physical. And it's trying to combine the two, but to do so under the tutelage of the gospel. You know, we've all got this compass in us that wants to be fully human. And we're figuring out what's best going to fulfill us. And Carl picked, you know, the physical realm includes so much. But one of those is financial, material. And material possessions are not bad. When they become idols, that's when it gets in trouble. But Carl, he wasn't a follower of Christ. Incredibly successful guy. I knew of at least 5 different companies that he had bought and sold. And, you know, he had his homes all over, you know, in the mountains and at the beach. And he thought he was doing pretty good. And until he had what he refers to as, it was just the conversation. It was a jolt for him with his adult son, who had lived with this man, watched him, now gone off. And the adult son was really beginning to grasp what it means to have a relationship with God through Christ. And he comes back to his dad, and he said point blank to him, he said, you know, you figured out how to build a lot of companies, but I'm not sure you've ever figured out how to love.
Hmm.
It just stopped Carl in his tracks. It sent him down a pursuit of, maybe I don't have this all figured out. And that notion of not being able to love, loved people are able to love people. And he started realizing he first needed to grasp the love of God in order to give it away. And that started bringing him back into a more of a full embrace of his humanity. He didn't leave his company and move to a cave in the mountains. He continued to lead companies and lead well, but he became a kingdom player. And he started realizing, you know what, I was way out of balance. And so his humanity had been out of kilter because he was emphasizing the physical over the spiritual.
And that's a look back at yesterday's episode, Live the Promise with Susie Larson. Coming up on today's episode, author and speaker Liz Curtis Biggs joins the program once again. Also, author Stephen Mansfield talking about his book, The Miracle of the Kurds. At 3 to 5 p.m. Central Time here on the Faith Radio Network with Susie Larson. It's now 6:58. Good morning. I'm Austin Hill. SRN News is on the way next.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
It's a beautiful day.
morning. 704, the Faith Radio Network is what you're listening to. I'm Austin Hill, honored to be with you weekday morning 6 till 8 as we seek to connect faith to life, even on one of the busiest travel days of the week. How do you like that? Yes, it's Thanksgiving week, and it's bound to be pretty crazy, especially if you have to travel anywhere near an airport, even if you're not flying somewhere, in some cases driving the car past the airport or trying to make your way through freeway or thoroughway traffic in and around an airport. That will be challenging. It is among the busiest of travel days in the year today. And we're glad you're with us. Coming up later this morning, we look forward to talking with author Abdu Murray. If you've heard this program before, chances are you've heard Mr. Murray before. He's author of a book called Grand Central Question. Now, Mr. Murray himself, very intriguing story. Professionally, he practices law in Detroit, Michigan. He was raised as a Muslim and in his adult life became an evangelical Christian. He speaks prolifically about issues of deciphering a very pluralistic multi-faith culture as an evangelical Christian in America in the modern era. Later this hour, he'll join us to talk about the problem of Islamic radicalization. Now, he's been with us before in the program to address this issue. He'll be back with us again later this hour. And he's quick to point out, I would offer this as just a little footnote here before we speak to him. He is quite direct, very gracious, very thoughtful, very deliberate, however, in his remarks. Very quick to point out that the radicalization of young people is happening in growing numbers in Western Europe, in the United States, and around Canada, throughout North America. And he's also said, listen, if you're a pastor, you're a parent, you're a Christian, heading up a Christian household, no matter, kids can be radicalized if the church is not meeting their needs and answering their deepest questions in life. So talk about the church and radical Islam with our friend Abdu Murray coming up later this hour here on the Faith Radio Network. By the way, I talked a bunch about this last hour. Just a reminder, I do hope you'll get over to myfaithradio.com, hopefully sooner rather than later, and find out how you can get involved with Angel Tree, a program of Prison Fellowship Ministries. Angel Tree, of course, an annual event that serves the children of incarcerated adults, children that are oftentimes, in many cases, without a parental figure or a steady parental figure in their life at all. And in many ways, they are absolutely without any Christmas gifts or hope or encouragement or even adult mentor presence at this time of the year. Now, we've got a special phone number set up for Faith Radio listeners. Make a note of this, if you would. It's 855-59-ANGEL. 855-59-ANGEL. Real easy. In fact, if you would be so kind, I would respectfully invite you to make that call right now and pledge your support to help out kids of incarcerated adults here even before December starts. Now, for $84, one low cost of $84, you can reach six kids. For $169, you can capture a dozen children. And as we've talked about before, yeah, you don't know exactly where the gift goes. You don't know exactly who the child is, whose life you might touch. But we do know that the results of it come back in very, very big ways. It's called Angel Tree, a program of Prison Fellowship Ministries. Hope you'll join me, join us here at Faith Radio in serving the needs and interests of children who have incarcerated parents here at the Advent season, the Christmas season. 855-59-ANGEL is our number, 855-59-ANGEL. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Welcome to Tuesday morning. I'm Austin Hill. We're glad you're with us. Morning, it's now 7:10, and this is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Thank you for being with us this morning. Where do we go to find out about world events and the plight of Christians living abroad? Well, oftentimes some of the most important things going on with Christians all over the world completely escape our dominant news media outlets here in the U.S. That's why we go to Mission Network News. Our great friend Greg Yoder, who's the executive director of Mission Network News, joins us once again on our morning program. Greg, welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Well, thanks. Good to be back with you.
This is something very serious that I have seen zero coverage of, except with your organization's website. The Islamic State, sometimes referred to as ISIS, ISIS, sometimes also referred to as ISIL. The Islamic State, this quasi-military nation-state terrorist group, actually is, quote-unquote, setting up offices in the country of Pakistan. These are not terrorists that are on the run necessarily or hiding in caves and sleeper cells and whatnot. They've got their own offices. That's just stunning to me. What's going on here, Greg Yoder?
Well, in Pakistan, and you got to remember that Osama bin Laden was living in Pakistan when he was killed by the military. They have elements of radical Islam that are obviously pervasive in Pakistan. They have the anti-conversion law. It's illegal for anyone to convert to Christianity in Pakistan. It's illegal. But there are elements of radical Islam that are there. And what we uncovered this week, actually, with an organization that is working with the underground church there, is that offices have already been established by ISIS. In fact, Pakistani Muslims are using these offices to be dispersed into Syria, to Iraq, and now we're hearing Libya, and having leaders within the ISIS coalition coming out of Pakistan, and nobody's talking about this. Now, you think about this. This is a scary situation. If ISIS takes over Pakistan, and we're not saying that that is going to happen, but that's in the back of my mind, and I'm sure many listeners' mind, what happens if that happens? They have nuclear weapons, and that just gives them incredible power and bargaining chips and really puts a situation where the West has very limited action in, as it relates to what they do with ISIS in terms of combating them, putting them down, going up against them in a military conflict, etc. And you think, too, I just saw an article a couple of days ago, the fact that there are maybe 200,000 fighters with Islamic State. This is a huge deal.
It absolutely is a huge deal, and it's stunning to me. We have gone from a situation that only a few years ago had the bad guys, the Islamic State terrorists, those who would do harm in the West and those kinds of things, they were, quote-unquote, on the run. 10 years ago, the mantra from our president was, we're fighting the bad guys over there, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, wherever, so we can live freely and safely here. Now we see this proliferation of terrorist attacks in North America, both in the United States and Canada, and Pakistan is apparently so, not uncomfortable with the threat of the Islamic State that some of these guys are able to actually, what, do they rent office space? I mean, do they have a DBA? Do they have a mailing address? They've got phone service? I mean, I'm not trying to be funny here, but officing, setting up an office when you're a terrorist group, that is just an extraordinary turn of events, Greg Yoder, that suggests kind of mainstream cultural acceptance. Can you comment on that?
Well, I can only tell you what we've been told by Forgotten Missionaries International, and they're the ones that are working in these areas. And the ones who are quoting the Christians who are in Pakistan that are seeing this firsthand, you know, they're saying 90% of the leadership is in Pakistan, not Afghanistan. They're saying that the hunt for Al-Qaeda, the mastermind Osama bin Laden, was in Pakistan. And although Taliban leaders swore allegiance to Islamic State the last month, Bruce Allen with this organization says that the Pakistan government denies an ISIS presence in their country altogether. And so they're actually living in denial, but they're there. And what's interesting is that Christians understand that if ISIS gets a hold of Pakistan, they're going to have to leave.
I would certainly think that's the case. Greg Yoder, he is the executive director of Mission Network News. That's a nonprofit news agency devoted to reporting on the plight of Christians as they live abroad outside the U.S. and the challenges and victories both that they face. Greg, let's move on to the country of Indonesia. Mission Network News reporting that there's been sort of an about-face, a change, a shift in Indonesia. Still the most Islamic nation in the world, as I understand Indonesia to be, but they've had a shift when it comes to religious freedom. What's going on here?
Well, as you mentioned, Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim country. We have talked about stories about Islam and its conflict with Christians over the years. Maybe 10 years ago, over Christmas, it always seemed to rear its ugly head where there was violence by Muslims against Christians during those religious holidays. And it's kind of died down over the years. Well, they have a new president right now that is, he's one of those reformers, and he wants change. He doesn't want to have where in Indonesia is known as a Muslim nation. They're actually proposing some legislation that would require religious minorities to have the freedom that they are so due and are guaranteed by God. And so they're proposing a bill that he says will come before Parliament within the next 6 months to protect religious minorities that include Christians. And this is just off the chart crazy. I mean, we never would have thought this was ever going to happen 10 sure. years ago. But until now, the government recognized six religions: Islam, Protestantism, Catholicism, Hinduism, Taoism, and Buddhism. But Nettleton, Todd Nettleton, who's with Voice of the Martyrs, says that the issue wasn't a religious one so much as a reaction to the political landscape of the time. And so we're actually going to be seeing some changes if this does indeed happen. Now, it's just a proposed law right now. It's going before Parliament. But this could actually be changed on their ID cards. They actually have ID cards, which you have to post what your religion is. They want that actually to be removed from their ID cards.
My goodness. So, I mean, this is the nation, Indonesia, that has the world's largest Muslim population in it, actually moving towards greater, shall we say, religious diversity, tolerance, and inclusiveness, so to speak.
Yes, and what's interesting is, of course, you have radical Islam there as well. And they're pushing hard against this legislation. And so we're going to see exactly, you know, how this president, who is viewed as a reformer, see how much power he actually has within this country and see what happens. This could cause a schism within this nation and potentially some extreme violence by radical Islam against anyone else who is agreeing with this type of legislation in this country.
Very interesting. All right, stand by for more. Our great friend Greg Yoder with Mission Network News, a nonprofit group devoted to reporting the news of the church abroad, Christians living outside the U.S., making sure we know what's really going on here within the United States. We'll continue with Greg Yoder in just moments. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. It's now 7:20. Breakpoint on the way in moments here on the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Things becoming actually more hostile, while in other parts of the world, conditions may actually become more accommodating. That's always, oftentimes anyway, kind of the plight of the Christian church and the Christian movement, if you will, abroad. Greg Yoder from Mission Network News. He's the executive director of that nonprofit news agency. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network as he gets us caught up on some of the big developments worldwide. Greg, let's go to the country of Nigeria. Mission Network News has reported on this, and specifically this group known as Boko Haram. Apparently, Boko Haram now forcing Christian ministries to relocate, and it appears as though some of them even being forced to relocate out of Nigeria. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, when you think of Nigeria, of course, you have to look at the north and the south. The northern portion of the country is predominantly Muslim or Islamic, and then the southern portion of the country is non-Muslim, or they call it Christian. And so when you look at that and see the divide, and understanding that you have a Christian president and then radicals in the north called Boko Haram who want an Islamic state, similar to what we're seeing in the caliphate around the world in Syria and Iraq, you can understand the problem. And yes, Boko Haram has been forcing ministries to relocate. We just aired a story not too long ago about this. In fact, Christian Aid Mission, which actually supports indigenous missionaries within these nations, specifically Nigeria, it feels that the ripple effects of their activity, they've actually had to move their office from a northern section of Nigeria to another location because of the increasing violence that's happening there. Christians didn't want to do it because they just view that as not believing that God will protect them. But just out of sheer necessity, they had to do it and are still trying to raise dollars to actually facilitate that complete move. But thankfully, they've been able to do it. And it's literally been people grabbing their things and going because of the violence and so forth. A lot of a commotion that they've had to deal with, and children, of course, having to be uprooted from their things that they're used to. It's been a huge deal for them. But it's not just Christian Aid Mission and the people that they're supporting. There are many organizations that have been Christians have been supporting in this area, schools, some ministries, especially aid organizations, Christian aid organizations that have literally been forced out. And to think of all the stories that we've had about churches that have been burned to the ground, Christians that have been attacked, and even, of course, you remember the schoolgirls who were kidnapped, almost 7 months ago now. The violence has been pretty profound.
It sounds to me, Greg Yoder, entailed in not all of that, but much of it, is potential threats on the lives of Christians in all of the various regions of Nigeria. Am I hearing that correctly?
Mostly in the north. When you get to the south of Jos, you're not seeing as much violence. Of course, hardly any violence because it's obviously predominantly Christian or non-Muslim. But once you get into the north, you start seeing the tensions between the two groups. And in fact, where Boko Haram is present, Christians aren't even there anymore. They've been forced out.
Mm-hmm. Greg Yoder from Mission Network News. What's the big takeaway here as those of us here in the United States, as we hunker down and celebrate family and give thanks for our many blessings and then head into the Advent season? And relatively speaking, most all of us are living in safety, in freedom, in comfort, and yet so many of our brothers and sisters around the world, nothing could be further from the truth. What's the big thing for us to be mindful of, would you say?
Well, the takeaway is that God is still in control, and we need to realize that even Jesus taught that if we love him, we're going to be persecuted. We're going to face those kinds of trials. And so the good news is, because of all this persecution, the church is growing in all of these areas that we mentioned. God is at work. People are coming to Christ. More Muslims are turning to Jesus today than ever before in the history of even being able to keep track of this. And so my prayer is that Christians in these nations will be bold. They'll stand firm in their faith, that they won't be ashamed of the gospel, and that they'll use these opportunities to be able to share Jesus in a way that they've never been able to do before. And in terms of us, yes, let's be thankful for our freedoms, but then let's do something about it. Let's not just sit on our hands and say, oh, we're going to pray for you. Let's go out and do something. Maybe it's giving financially. Maybe it's praying more specifically as a prayer group, or actually going somewhere and having an impact on many of these places that maybe need their churches rebuilt, or schools provided for, or just going over and doing humanitarian aid. What an opportunity we could have as Christians to actually be the hands and feet of Jesus and being a James 1:22 Christian.
Hmm. Greg Yoder with Mission Network News, keeping us apprised of some of the just amazing life stories of our brothers and sisters in Christ abroad. You can find him at MNN, like Mission Network News, MNNonline.org. And, of course, they are a nonprofit entity. Always welcome to your gifts. Greg Yoder, thanks as always for joining us. We love what you do, and we sure appreciate you taking some time this morning.
Well, thank you, Austin. We're very thankful for you and what you guys mean to the body of Christ as a whole, and we appreciate the opportunity to be able to share these stories.
727, good morning. This is the Faith Radio Network. Breakpoints with John Stonestreak and Eric Metaxas is on the way next. morning. It's 7:37. We're glad you're with us. It's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Radicalization of Western youth. Yes, you've probably heard that phrase before, especially in light of a couple of different terrorist attacks carried out by Canadian nationals, young men in the country of Canada, who became radicalized jihadists, as they are described, and turned against their own country and their own government. Could that happen to children in your neighborhood, or maybe kids in your own church? Joining us to talk about it, a man who addresses these issues very succinctly. He's an attorney by profession, raised as a Muslim. Today he is an evangelical Christian who, in addition to practicing law, actually has an apologetics ministry. Abdu Murray, he is the author of Grand Central Question. He addresses these issues of interfaith relations, cross-cultural tensions, and living in a multi-faith pluralistic society, does that distinctly from a biblical worldview. Abdu Murray, good to have you back with us. Welcome back to Faith Radio.
Well, thanks so much, Austin, for having me. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. Last time you were here on our program, you talked about some warning signs and actually warned parents and pastors alike that, hey, radicalization can happen to even our own kids and kids in our churches. And I think one of the things you said was, don't think this can't happen to kids in your church youth group. And now, literally just days after we had you on the program, comes this very interesting analysis from Canada. A young man up there, Martin Couture-Rolou, from the province of Quebec, kind of a middle-class kid in a suburb of Montreal, and seemingly enjoying a nice Western Canadian lifestyle. He is now a radical jihadist and has turned against his own country and committed some heinous acts. It was really kind of uncanny how the development of this very tragic situation in Canada kind of followed the things that, in some ways, you predicted. But give us your thoughts on that as you've watched this unfold in Canada and among our neighbors in the north.
Well, I do think that it fits, strangely so, fits with what I was saying before about you have these people who are essentially disillusioned or disenfranchised or whatever, you know, sort of fancy word we want to use, people who are feeling marginalized despite the fact that they're suburbanites, they're sort of growing up in a middle-class area, just sort of a very a nondescript sort of existence. They've had the usual problems that people usually have and all these things, and then bam, they become radicals in some way. I think as you look at this, there's some interesting parallels even between these kind of people like Martin Couture-Rolou and also the homeless man, Zehef Bibo, who did what he did in terms of the parliament shooting. You see this disillusionment, and of course Bibo was actually homeless and drug addicted and these kind of things, but you see these parallels with, I think, some of the shootings that have garnered, you know, so much attention, just white people who are kids or adults or whatever who sort of lose it and have this disillusioned ideas, and then they walk into a movie theater and do the things that they've done. There's a desire somewhere, I think, in these people for a sense of significance. What we're seeing, though, with the rise of the ISIS phenomenon and the headlines that it makes and sort of this bravado and this, where these small group of people are shaking the establishment, are causing these huge empires and these huge, you know, governments to quicken their boots. They're mm-hmm. saying, I can be significant now, so I can do something that makes headlines and lasts for eternity. And so they sort of gravitate towards these things, I think. And that's why you see people who are looking to express their anger or their angst or whatever it is, and then find an outlet. And not only find an outlet in terms of just violence, but they find it in terms of righteous violence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, the difference that we're seeing here, the subtle difference, and what's really dangerous is that they're seeing a sort of righteousness that attaches to their desire for violence anyway.
Mm-hmm. Abdu Murray publishes the website embracethetruth.org. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network. His book is entitled Grand Central Question. He's here talking about this very, very dangerous, quite frankly, pretty scary phenomenon known as the radicalization of youth. As you were describing the man who is now in custody and accused of the heinous break-in and the murder at the Parliament building in Ottawa, Canada, back a few weeks ago, you described him as a homeless man, and that there are those who are saying, probably without knowing a whole lot of concrete details, but they're saying, well, he was clearly a mentally ill man. That may very well have been the case. It seems to me that even in the case of a beheading that happened earlier this year in Oklahoma City, there were people who were quick to say, well, this was a crazy man. He had some kind of psychosis, and this is just terrible. There were psychological and psychiatric issues at play. My concern is, Abdu, that at times we'd rather talk about psychiatric disorders than we would like to talk about the fact that a lot of these crimes, these beheadings in particular, are being committed by people who profess the Islamic faith. Now, whether anybody wants to say that's a part of Islam or argue that it is not a part of Islam, there clearly is a pattern of people calling themselves Muslims, identifying with Allah, claiming that they're carrying out the edicts of the Quran and committing these heinous acts. Now, is there some clear way to delineate between mental health problems, psychiatric disorders, if you will, and a radical, religiously tinged ideology that's driving people to this behavior? How do you analyze that?
Well, I do think that there is, gosh, you know, sometimes there does become a bit of a fine line, or not a fine line, sorry, a blurred line. And
I would think so.
Fine sometimes. It's kind of broad and blurry. The problem is that it's so difficult to define this because people who are very much in their right minds, in terms of understanding what's right and wrong and what they think is right and wrong and capable of understanding the consequences of their actions, will then take parts of the Quran and the Hadith literature, which are the fundamentals of Islam, and then use that to justify their desire for violence. And there are some things that I think are troubling, and that Muslims are starting to wrestle with, moderate Muslims are beginning to wrestle with, and have to address themselves in light of recent events. So there are those who are fully in their right mind, who are capable of making rational decisions, and then have rationally chosen, not using their rationale, but because they're not, you know, deluded, they choose violence, and they justify that through their faith. But then there are those, like I think some people who may have mental illnesses, who are also taken advantage of by those very same people, by the way, the previous people who say we can sort of, you know, poison the minds of or influence the minds of those who might have very serious problems to do our bidding for us.
Right.
Is it easy to do it? No, it's not, because the outcomes are so similar. And the hard part for us is to think, especially in the Christian world, is to think, how could anybody in their right minds do these kinds of things?
It's so counter.
They're all nuts, but they're not all nuts.
Well, it is just so counterintuitive to our Judeo-Christian outlook on the world, to Western civilization, quite frankly, and certainly completely counter to those who are seeking to live as Christ would have us.
Yeah, you know, and here's the interesting thing about how we have to be careful when I agree with everything you just said, but I think we have to be careful too, because skeptics will use this and say, well, the Crusaders were in their right minds too, and the Inquisitors were in their right minds too when they did things, and they used these things to justify their beliefs. Of course, the counter to that is, I'd like to find one statement that Jesus made that would possibly justify the actions of some of the Crusaders or the actions of some of the people involved in the Inquisition. And, of course, there are none. I can't think of one thing Jesus would have said that would have given them justification for these things that either wasn't twisted or just don't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. But at the same time, the Bible actually predicts these things, which I think is what makes it so credible. The Bible tells us that the heart of man is desperately wicked and that men love darkness. And so when we see this darkness as Christians, this is the kind of thing we should actually expect. Not a flawed, of course, but expect. And then realize that the only thing that changes that darkness is the Christian message that we have to live out, but also spread. And if we're not doing that, if we're not reaching people like Martine and others at critical stages, you know, we miss an opportunity to correct and prevent some wrongs.
Well, with that, let's take a quick break. Abdu Murray, author of the book Grand Central Question, he is on our guest line here on Faith Radio as we talk about this phenomena, I call it. It's a huge problem, and it's something that, as Christians, we need to be well aware of, the problem of youth who become radicalized with radical Islam and turn on their country, their culture, perhaps their own families, and their Christian faith. More with Abdu Murray in just moments. I'm Austin Hill. This is the Faith Radio Network. 7:49. Good morning. Tuesday morning underway. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Welcome to Thanksgiving Week. Can youth in your own community, perhaps in your own church, become radicalized? Radicalized with an Islamic-laden agenda? My guest says we all need to be aware of this. Amdu Murray, back with us again. He is author of Grand Central Question. He is a prolific speaker, raised in the Islamic faith. He is an evangelical Christian today, a lawyer by profession, and also has a ministry of apologetics, addressing these very important issues of religious tensions in the world, getting along in a religiously pluralistic society, living out our Christian faith when not everybody around us agrees with this necessarily. Abdu Murray, last time you were with us here on our program, you noted that, hey, we need to get over this naive thinking that radicalization cannot happen with young people in our church or in our family, in our community and whatnot. And one of the eye-opening things that you enlightened us about is the fact that in many cases, young adults, teenagers as well, they have some pretty profound and deep questions about their existence. What are they here for? What is the human race about? And they're not getting those deep questions answered in church so much. And Islam comes along, or radical Islam, if we want to call it that, and purports to provide answers. Pick up on that where we left off there and tell us more about that dilemma, the longings of the heart of the young person that go unmet, so to speak.
Well, absolutely, and I think that that's really the heart of some of these issues, and it's a broad spectrum, too. You have these people who do these heinous acts in the matter of irreligion or their atheism, for example, like Dylan Klebold and the Harris young boy who did what he did in, so many years ago in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Those people were looking for answers as well. They didn't find them, and I'm not blaming the church, so to speak, but we do have an opportunity to provide them with the answers that are meaningful, and I don't think we're doing that in a way that we could as effectively do that. And the way to do that, I think, is to be mindful, be looking out for those people who might be troubling, who are looking for answers, and who might be saying, well, what are some of the answers that we have? What are some of the answers the Christian faith has? And it's not the Bible says it, I believe it, and that settles it kind of an answer. It's these are some deep, deep answers we can give them. And I think that when we don't, they look elsewhere. You know, there's a saying that nobody speaks from nowhere. And in other words, everyone has a worldview. And mm-hmm. if we don't come along with the Christian worldview and begin to tell them why we think the Christian worldview is credible, and in fact the most credible worldview there is, they're going to find another one, whether it's an atheistic or nihilistic, whatever it might be. But Islam is not a wallflower. It is a evangelistic religion, if you will. It wants to gain converts and gain followers, both moderate versions and radical versions. So if we don't answer the questions, someone's going to. There's a vacuum that's created by the lack of answers, and then someone is going to swoop in to the vacuum and answer those questions for our youth. And the question we always have to ask ourselves is, who are we allowing to answer those questions?
Wow.
If it's not us, then who? It's going to be somebody.
That's very well stated. You noted last time you were with us as well, Abdu Murray, that in many ways the way we go about the work of the church in evangelical churches is that we make the church experience, at least the worship experience, very much an entertaining phenomenon. Now, I'm not here to debate or be critical necessarily of sophisticated musical presentations with worship music or the use of drama and art and skits in the context of worship services. That's for a different time and place to have that conversation. Nonetheless, we deploy these things as tools in the church. They do become very entertaining, but you suggested that in some cases we focus in on making church fun and entertaining without addressing some of these deeper, more substantive areas of a young person's life, and we lose them in that case. Give us a couple of tips for parents of teenagers, for youth pastors, or any pastor who's trying to get through to the next generation. Give us a couple of tips for making sure that we're addressing some of the more deeper needs of our young people.
Great question. I think a great thing to do, I just took part of this in one of the largest churches in Michigan, actually. They held a skeptics night where they asked Christians, bring your non-Christian friends, or if you have questions, bring them. They're safe here. no judgments whatsoever. Your toughest questions are safe here. And then bring someone in, like myself, or someone who's really well-versed in the Bible or other worldviews or whatever, to answer the questions openly and honestly. And you can even do it anonymously by having them text it in, or, you know, or on Facebook or whatever it is, so no one has to know who asked that question.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, we had such a response. Hundreds of people came forward, either nominal Christians whose faith were flagging or people who made new commitments to Christ right there because they finally realized the church is willing to answer my questions. So something like that, do an event like that. But then in your youth groups, you know, whether it's for activities that are fun or whatever it might be, I've seen really great youth pastors who will go and meet with these kids one-on-one and ask them, so what's going on with you? What are you looking for? What are the answers? You know, what are the questions you have? And if I don't have the answers, can you meet with somebody who does?
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you somebody else, you know, that kind of thing. If we get invested specifically in their questions and in their lives, I think that there'll be a big payoff at the end. It comes from Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 to 6, and this is how I govern my ministry, is that Paul says specifically that we are to make the best use of the time and let our speech be always seasoned with salt and gracious, so that we may know how to answer each person. Not each question, but each person. And that's the key there, because people have some of the same questions, but it's different because someone different is asking.
Yep.
And I think as youth leaders, as church leaders, we need to understand that these are people with questions, and they need the answers. Their questions don't need answers, but they do.
Yeah, that's just the way the scriptural reference there is referenced, the way it's been interpreted, and the way the Apostle Paul worded it, really places emphasis on the human individual, not just the ideology or the philosophy.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And we, if we understand that, people develop their worldviews based on their own cries of the heart or their own struggles or whatever they, you know, have gone through. And if we take time to invest in who they are, and understand their backgrounds, I think then we can say, not only what is your question, but why are you asking it?
Very well stated, as always. He's Abdu Murray, author of the book Grand Central Question. We've got info on him on our website at myfaithradio.com. Find him there. He's the publisher of EmbraceTheTruth.org. Abdu Murray, as always, thanks so much for joining us. You are a very strategic and thoughtful person in very troubled and strategic times. We appreciate your ministry, your outreach, and we look forward to talking again soon.
I do too, Austin. Thank you again for the opportunity.
It's now 7:57. Back in moments as we put a wrap-up on today's program from Faith Radio. Thanks for being here. I'm Austin Hill. I'm here every weekday, 6 till 8 in the morning, as we seek to connect faith to life. Hope you'll join us. Come on board and help out with Angel Tree, a program of prison fellowship ministry. Here's that number. It's toll-free, 855-59-ANGEL. Join me, join us here at Faith Radio. Step up and support children of incarcerated adults here during the Christmas and Advent season. Call right now, 855-59-ANGEL. Easy to remember, 855-59-ANGEL. I'll see you tomorrow morning here. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.